Welcome to Bridging the Gap. I'm David McDonald. Today we'll be speaking with Hala. We've interviewed Hala before, where she gave her testimony about how the Lord healed a 5.9 centimeter cancerous tumor that was in her throat that was threatening her life, and the surgeons were blown away, and she's back singing now, traveling throughout Latin America and North America. She will be speaking today about her experience in Peru and the incredible poverty in the garbage cities where babies are being thrown in garbage cans and where nuns rescue them out of those garbage heaps. We'll also be speaking with Marco Lopez, who is a full-time music minister in Mexico. We caught up with him in Guatemala City. Finally, Father John Gillians, who is an Orthodox priest and a professor of theology at the University of St. Paul, will talk about the early Christians, the Hellenists, the Greeks, and Hebrews, and how the Bible came to us. Please join us for the next 30 minutes on Bridging the Gap. We'll pick up the conversation backstage after Hala's concert in Guatemala City. Hala was a fantastic show. You know, the people, you just really had them in tears. It was just remarkable to see the audience just really engaged, and your commitment to Christ just really came through. I could really feel that there were people who may not know Christ who were there tonight who now know him because of what you're doing. And did a 2-hour show, like, but is it a good tired?
It's a very good tire. It's a tiredness of thanking God of the experience that I had up there at stage, sharing it with all the Guatemala people. It was just wonderful. My payback was that frame, that picture where everybody was giving each other a hug, and at the same time they were crying and thanking God for that son, thanking God for that daughter, for that husband, for that wife, for that brother in Christ that they were hugging and that he needed a hug. It was just, that's my payback after the concert.
And part of your heart for doing what you're doing right now, ministering to families here in Guatemala, is because of what you've seen, not only from your own family, but seeing in the sort of machoism and stuff. And what is it that has driven you to really want to get on this in Latin America?
Well, what it is that I lived in a family where my dad was a machoism. You know, he would beat up my mom really bad. And I know that that stays in your heart. It's like a mark that you carry with you. And only the Lord can heal that. And that's what I want to tell the people of Latin America, where all this machismo is like really up there, you know, really high. And men think that that's being intelligent, like I was saying on my concert. That's not intelligence. The truth intelligence is the intelligence that we get from God, from him living his 10 amendments that he left us.
Do you see any link between the alcoholism that you see and a sort of spousal abuse?
Oh yeah, definitely. The alcohol drags you to get that abuse, not only verbally, but, you know, physically. You know, all these women, I was talking today at the concert about this lady that she was first abused sexually, and back then in Mexico, it was like a bad thing. It was like this dishonor of the family. She had to get married, so they marry her to this guy that drank, that beat her up every night, and she would not say anything to her mom, not to cause her problems. But she was living this life that affected her children. And now her daughter is 42 years old. She immigrated U.S. She lives in Texas, and her daughter is an alcoholic, and she uses drugs and has 3 kids. She doesn't even know who the dad is. And the last time that I was there in Austin, Texas, she was telling me about her daughter. She had just gotten her out of jail. So you see that the alcohol does not leave anything good. It's like a change. They change you, and you don't have liberty to really, you know, love and live a happy life. Like this daughter, you know, her dad was an alcoholic. She learned it from him. How is he going to tell her daughter, don't do it, if he taught her that?
Wow. And one of the other things that you've seen in Latin America, particularly here in Guatemala, you've traveled into the areas around Guatemala, the small cities, and you've seen some of the wake of the hurricane that's come through here, and you've seen some incredible poverty. Tell us a little bit about that.
I saw little houses only wrapped around with cardboard, with clothing, patches here and there. I mean, there's not even a sewage. They don't even have regular bathrooms like we do. It's like a whole cover up with the little blankets and little kids running around, drinking water from the running water in the street. Little kids that are naked, their little stomachs are swelled up because of the lack of food, and they just swelled up because of all that dirt they eat, that water that they drink. And one of the places where the hurricane hit, I mean, it was a place where it was very hot. The temperature was very hot. There was no water at all, no electricity, so they couldn't get anything. So a bottle of 2 ounce of water bottle that I had with me, it was like a treasure, you know, it was like gold. And I was like drinking little zips so it will not finish. So you kind of value what you have back at home, and seeing all this poverty, seeing that aldea, they called it aldea, which is a little city that got buried totally from the hurricane. It was under dirt, and you would see the people that the family of these people that lived there in that aldea, that worked in the city, came back to their town and saw everything buried. They didn't even try getting the people out because automatically they called it a cemetery. It was just terrible to see that.
And tell me about the faith that you saw coming out of the wreckage of that incident.
Oh gosh, the faith of those people seeing those places dig, trying to find their families. And one of the things that really catch my attention was to get there and seeing this guy, you know, still digging to find his family. And finally he got one of his kids out and got on his knees, lift that little child up in the sky without no life no more. He was buried for days, and he lifted up in the sky and said, thanks, Lord. Thank you, Lord, for taking everything away from me. But I still thank you for this. So that, I thought that was really amazing. And not only that, but the little towns that I went through and did concerts, seeing the faith of the little kids when the prayer was on, they don't get distracted like I've seen in U.S. or Mexico. The little kids are running around when somebody's doing the prayer. Not in Guatemala. In Guatemala, the little kids lift their hands up and start crying and talking to the Lord about their poverty, about their father, about their mom, about their uncle, their brother that is in drugs or drinking. And those little kids have faith, and it's a faith that I've never seen anywhere else.
You've traveled around a lot of South America and all over the Spanish world. You're very well known. I did notice that today. And you're using that gift to serve the Lord, which is a wonderful thing. But you told me about a story in Peru of the incredible poverty and some of the horrible things that you saw.
Yes, I visited Peru, and some of the nuns took us after the tour that we had in Peru in different areas. And she says, you have to go see this place because you need to see this. If you're a missionary, you need to see this. We go out there. She says, don't take anything, nothing valuable. Don't take earrings. Take off your watches, your rings. Just go as simple as you can. And she took us in a bus. us. And as soon as we started going, it was like a city, a small city, but it was a trash city. Literally trash. When they told me that we were going to go to the trash city, I just couldn't imagine how it would be. And then all of a sudden I start seeing, you know, buildings that are almost falling down. There's all this graffiti going on and trash. That's where all the people that sell their crops, like lettuces, like, you know, carrots or whatever the crops they have in there, the bad stuff now, they go and trash it there. And you see piles of trash and just regular trash on top of vegetables and all this that is trash because it's no good no more. But all that drains, you know, all the liquid from the lettuce, the sun hits it or water, rains, whatever, and it drains in the ground. And you see like black water type of thing that smells bad. We had to cover our nose in the bus to even, you know, be there because the smell was just terrible. And seeing around that trash, that big, oh, it's like a little mountain of trash, and seeing little kids digging into it and putting stuff in their mouth from that dirt. You see that stuff and it just hurts your stomach. You really want to vomit and say, my God, why isn't people doing something about this, you know? 2 miles away, you see all these, you know, huge buildings of famous or rich people. And 2 blocks later on, you see this trash city and nobody's doing anything about it. She takes us all the way in. You see people on the floor living there, cover up with cardboard. You can go around and lift cardboard and you'll find a whole family under all those trash living there. And you ask them, what are you doing here? This is my home. Like nothing. And we went to Mother Teresa of Calcutta house that she built there. And the first floor, it's all for the older people that they go out there and they pick. They're dying of hunger and they're dirty. And once they see that they're really dying, they grab them, they take them in the house, they wash them, they clean them, they feed them. Second floor, it's all children. Children with disabilities, mental, physical. But there was one little girl that dragged my attention. Beautiful girl, beautiful hair. She had 2 ponytails and was dragging on her little wheelchair. Her legs are twisted the other way, not normal. They're like backwards. It's weird to see her. She has like a blanket on top of her legs. When you lift that blanket, I mean, you could see her little legs like patched up, like she got sewed, you know, like a blanket that has a hole and you patch it like that. All her little legs. And I asked the nun, what happened to her? And the nun told me something that I just couldn't believe that she was telling me. She's like, we go outside every night into the trash city looking for human noises. I said, what? What is that? She's like, trying to hear human noises in the middle of the trash. One night, we were going out with a flashlight, of course, because it's dark there. There's hardly any electricity going in there. And she said that she kind of slid, almost slipped and almost fell. And she looked down with a flashlight and saw a puddle of blood. And I was like, wow. And they started digging, you know, looking through the trash. What's going on? What's in here? And they started finding a piece of a finger, a piece of a foot, a leg crushed up, and they started grabbing those little pieces of a human being. It was a baby that a car had just gone through, I guess, and stepped on that little kid that her own mother went out there and threw in the trash, either because she's a prostitute or because she has no money or ways to raising that little girl. She didn't want to have an abortion, but she did went and throw her in the trash. You know, what difference does that make, you know? People that go out there and just throw out away little kids that come out with mental problems, with disabled problems. They go and throw them in there. And these nuns go in there and grab them. She grabbed that little girl in pieces from her waist down. She was all pieces. They picked them up, put them in their vest, their nun vest, went into the hospital. The doctor told them, there's no way this little girl can make it. The nun says, you know, try everything that's in your hands. If the Lord wants this child to live, he'll do his part. You guys do your part, he'll do his. Sure enough, hours and hours of surgeries in there, they come out and they said the little girl is alive. And that's the little girl that I saw in the Casa Mother Teresa of Calcuta in Lima, Peru, in a wheelchair, happy as she can be, smiling at you, normal as she can be, happy that she's there. And just amazing story of that little girl, how she is here because of the Lord, wanted her to be there.
Reminds me of when someone asked Mother Teresa of Calcutta what she thought about, you know, the poverty that was in the East. She says, well, the financial poverty that we see in the East is nothing compared to the spiritual poverty of the West. And it's a real challenge to us as North Americans to respond to that challenge and to say, what are we going to do about that? And so, you know, for you folks out there who are looking at sponsoring a child through various child care organizations, children in the third world, I really encourage you. I have a little kid in India that I sponsor, and it's just a wonderful experience to see them grow up, and they send you pictures and all that kind of stuff. I just really want to thank you, Hela, for coming in and you know, telling us a little bit about what your experiences have been in your travels and trying to bring the Lord to people who really need Him so terribly bad. And when they do get Him, they have everything that we in the West need, which is the Lord. So thanks so much, Hela, and I hope you have a great tour on the rest of your voyage.
Thank you for letting me share some of these things about the, you know, what the Lord has shown me, and seeing that to me is a challenge. Everybody that's listening to this program, we have a challenge out there, and it's really a challenge of taking the Word of God, that spiritual lack that we have nowadays. We need to take it out there and say, you know what? There's a Lord that loves you. No matter what your problem is, you can do it. You can do it with that kid, without a husband or whatever, but you can do it. And that's what we need to take out there, the energy of the Lord. Push him in and say, you know what? You're not alone. Somebody is there with you, sharing your problems, sharing your lack of love that you feel. Hey, there's somebody that already died for you. And that's what we need to tell the people and the world out there. And it was a challenge to me to see that and say, you know what? It's nothing what I'm doing compared to these nuns, what they're doing. Because they go out there and tell those people that are selling drugs like candies in the trash world, don't do it. There's a God that loves you. You can do something better. So I challenge you, people that are listening to this program, everybody, whoever you are, wherever you are, in a car, in a house, wherever you're listening to this, there's a need. There's a need for us to talk about love, the love that Jesus gave us.
Thanks so much, Hela. With me here, Marco Lopez, and our translator Guillermo Gámez, who's also hosting us this week at the Eventos Catholicos, where Marco, myself, and Hela, and 15 other singers from around the world have been performing. Marco, when did you realize that Jesus was more than just a figment of history, that he was really present in the world and in your own life?
Yo entré a la iglesia cuando tenía 10 años de edad, empecé a participar en la
adoración. Marco says that his experience with God was at 15 years old. When he was 10 years old, he used to go to mass and sing for him. But at 15 years old, the economy of the family was in a bad situation. His parents, they got divorced. So it was worse for him. He had to quit studying and go to find a job along with his brother. So he was like blaming God for everything that happened.
Yo seguía participando en la iglesia.
That he became an alcoholic, but he still went to mass and preached and say good things about God. When he was 17 years old, he wanted to suicide. He couldn't do it, so then he realized that he had to change his way. He says that he had a girl in that festival. She told him that it was guys like him that made a bad example for youth, that he used to preach and talk well in the church, but out of church he used to get drunk and do things not proper for a good Catholic. That he was a bad example for the youth. The sparkle that lit the candle was the conversation with his friend. He really started thinking about what he was doing with his life. So the next day he went to the chapel and asked the Lord to make a miracle, because he was preaching and he was singing good things about the Lord, but he didn't feel them.
Yo siento que soy un mediocre, que estoy perdiendo el tiempo, te he pedido tantas veces.
If you are the real Lord, you have to make a miracle in my life, because I don't know how to get out of this. The change didn't come the next day, but it suddenly started happening. His faith grew and grew, and he finally realized that it was what the Lord wanted and what he wanted too.
And I'm so glad that you got out of the alcoholism. As somebody who's gotten out of that world, I can certainly relate, and I rejoice whenever somebody gets out of it. And you know, you've been traveling all over Latin America for the last 9 years, and what a great ministry that's been. Thanks so much for being with us here on Bridging the Gap.
Thank you. Miro hacia el cielo y veo que está viniendo mi Salvador.
Changing gears and coming back here to North America, we're going to speak with Father John Gillians, who is a Orthodox priest and also a professor of theology at the University of St. Paul. He's going to be talking about the early Christians, the Greeks, the Hebrews, and the Hellenists.
All Christians give the Bible a central place as the Word of God. Sure, there have always been lots of debates about what this means, which is why there are so many Christian churches today. But the Bible is the book that, to one degree or another, guides the lives of the churches. Christians added the New Testament to what they eventually called the Old Testament, the Hebrew Scriptures. But this took some time. For more than 40 years after the death and resurrection of Jesus, there was not a single written gospel. The rest of the New Testament writings weren't finished until near the end of the first century. And by that time, there were other books and letters in circulation that never made it into the New Testament. In fact, we don't have a complete list of the New Testament books as we now know them until the year 367 AD, when St. Athanasius, the Bishop of Alexandria in Egypt, listed them in his Easter message. Now for me, all of this raises three important questions. First, what did Christians do before they had a New Testament? Second, who decided and how did they decide what books to include in the Bible? And third, what bridged the gap between the New Testament writings and the continuing life of the Christian community? In other words, how did the Christian communities deal with the new questions, problems, and threats to their life that the Bible had not answered? Christian history is full of such decisions by people who, through their courage, testimony, and God's grace, preserved the faith of the Christian church for future generations. These are the sort of questions I would like to look at. We have some hints about this in the book of Acts, chapter 6, when the early church community faced a conflict between Hebrews and Hellenists. The church in the first century was multicultural, even when it was mainly made up of people from Jewish backgrounds, before Gentiles, the non-Jews, started to enter the church in large numbers. And these Jewish Christians could broadly be divided into two groups, Hebrews and Hellenists. The Jews in Palestine spoke Aramaic, the language Jesus spoke, and in the synagogue and early house churches, they were most comfortable in Hebrew. These were the Hebrews. But there were many other Jews who had grown up outside Palestine in the Jewish communities of Egypt, Asia Minor, Italy, and Greece. It was not unusual for people to be scattered around the Roman Empire. Jews who made their way back to Palestine were much more comfortable speaking Greek. These were the Hellenists, and they were definitely the minority. What happened when people from these two groups became followers of Jesus, the Messiah? Well, at first there was complete unity. As Acts says, all who believed were together and had all things in common. And day by day, attending the temple together and breaking bread in their homes, they partook of food with glad and generous hearts, praising God and having favor with all the people. The breaking of the bread was a code phrase for the Eucharist. This was precisely the way that Luke and Cleopas knew that it was the risen Jesus they had met on the road to Emmaus. They knew him through the breaking of the bread. Without the benefit of a New Testament book, the early Christians experienced the presence of the risen Christ in their midst through the Eucharist, Holy Communion. We can say that the early communities were shaped by their celebration of the Eucharist, long before they had the written pages of the Gospels. But back to the Hebrews and Hellenists. It did not take long for trouble to start. As the communities started getting larger and caring for more and more people in need, especially widows, the Hellenists murmured against the Hebrews because their widows were neglected in the daily distribution of food, as the book of Acts says. Seeing this brewing storm, having no direction from the Scriptures, having no New Testament at all, the 12 apostles nevertheless felt empowered to make a decision. They decided first to devote themselves to prayer and preaching, but they also decided to create a new group of helpers. The apostles instructed the assembly of the disciples to choose 7 deacons to oversee the distribution of food. This process was collaborative. The apostles made the decision, but they left the choice of deacons up to the assembly. And the disciples then made a remarkable and godly choice. All the deacons were from among the Greek-speaking Hellenists, the minority who had felt so slighted. And then again, a sign of collaboration with the apostles. The people brought the new deacon candidates to the apostles, who prayed and laid their hands on them to ordain them to this work. Jesus did not leave a manual for his church, but he did leave his Spirit, his apostles, and the Eucharist, and this was more than enough to guide them in their decisions.
Thanks, Father John Jillians, for giving us a sketch into what was going on in the early Christian communities before they had the New Testament and after the resurrection. In section 1426 to 1430 of the Catechism, we are invited to have a second conversion, to have a personal encounter with Christ. It is a part of our Catholic faith. My prayer is that for those of you who may not have had that experience, that you will invite Christ to be the Lord of your life. If you'd like to get in contact with Bridging the Gap or order a copy of this show on CD, you can find us online at CatholicBridge.com. That's www.CatholicBridge.com. We'd love to hear from you. Until then, may God richly bless you and your family. I'm David MacDonald. Thanks so much for being with us.